Yeah.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Questions from the Audio Road. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford, and I'll be taking your calls and answering your questions for the next hour or so. Lisa is here with us, screening calls and keeping things light and fun. If you want to join in, simply press 1 on your phone, and Lisa will be right with you. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. Sit back, relax, and listen, or jump in and ask your question. You can even bring us your opinion. It's up to you. This is your show. You can ask questions about fuel mileage, tires, engine, EGR, aerodynamics, truck specing, maintenance, taxes, financial planning, getting started as an owner-operator, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the audio road.
Hi, this is Lisa. Remember to talk to Kevin. Press 1 so I can pick up the phone and screen your calls. You know you'd rather talk to me anyway. Or just sit back, relax, and listen to the show. And at any time you have a question, just hit 1 and I'll pick up the phone.
Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. We'll be here for the next hour taking your calls and answering your questions. We are live. If you're on the call with us, go ahead and press 1. At any time, Lisa will screen your calls. It's open phone lines tonight. Anything you want to talk about, it's completely up to you. Trucks, money, taxes, politics, you name it. If you've got issues, if you've got questions, whatever it might be, if you're listening online and you want to join us on the call, there are still some phone lines open. You can dial 347-884-8327. That'll get you live on the call with us. You can listen right on your phone throughout the entire show, and you can jump in with a question. That number again, 347-884-8327. That'll get you live on the call. Once you're there, press 1. Wide open lines right now. There are no questions. So if you want to jump in, go ahead and press 1. Lisa will screen your calls. I'm going to get to some rates, and then we'll get to your calls. All right, the Market Demand Index. This is the index that measures available freight against available trucks. Remember, there's we want the number to go up. That's what we're always looking for when it comes to this index. There are a couple ways that the index can go up. If we have more freight, that should make the index go up. If we have less trucks, that can make the index go up because we're not measuring just freight, we're measuring freight against trucks. So it's even possible that when freight goes down, the index itself can go up. If truck availability goes down more than freight availability, the index can still climb. The magic number that we've been looking for in this index is 7, because that's kind of the tipping point to when we have enough negotiation power as the carriers that we can start to influence rates. Now, we hadn't been above 7 in 2 years, and we finally went above 7 3 weeks ago. Now, the index is up again. We are up this week to 7.69. The last 3 weeks have been 7.01, 7.42, now we're at 7.69, although the index is up, load availability is actually down. We were down 11%, but truck availability was down as well. So overall, that still means we've got more available freight per available truck. So that's a good sign, and I expect that we're going to see more of that. In fact, who did I make? I made a bet with somebody last week. We bet $1. I just have to remember who it was because they owe me $1. That somebody bet that the index, I think it was Lance. Lance, if you're on the call, raise your hand. You owe me $1. We bet that the index wasn't going to go up this week, and it did. Rates, though, still kind of hanging out. In fact, actually, equipment rates were down a little bit. Nothing major. The overall rate down 1% to $1.65. Flatbed rates were up from $1.50 to $1.53 this week. Reefer rates were up from $1.66 to $1.69. Van rates were flat at $1.47. Specialized took a pretty big hit, down 6% to $1.89. That was from $2.01 the week before. Fuel prices are actually on the rise, $2.90. That's a good thing. I'm really hoping we break that $3 mark here soon and stay there for a while. Let's look at the, that is from the Internet Truck Stop. Let me see what their outlook is. They're not predicting a whole lot from this one. So we'll take a look at that again next week. Let's look at what's going on over at TransCore 360, which is the DAT network. This one gives us more detailed analysis. We can look at week over week, month over month, and we can also look at year over year, and we can look at dry van, flatbed, and reefer as individual segments. So let me go through these numbers real quick. Week over week, the spot market load index is up 7%. Month over month, comparing February to January, up 52%. Year over year, February of 2010 against February of 2009, we're up 168%. That's the market overall. We look at dry van load to truck ratio, week over week up 10%, month over month 51%, year over year 245%. Flatbed load to truck week over week up 13%, month over month 109%, year over year 495% increase in the flatbed. And I talked to several people this week that had actually parked flatbeds because the segment had gotten so bad, and they've been watching the market, and they are all putting that equipment back to use. So those are the kind of things that we may see affecting things. If there's equipment parked and people start putting it back to use, I also believe that as the economy heats up a little bit and if fuel prices continue to climb, we're going to see some fallout in the market as well. Sometimes it's kind of interesting that when the market starts to pick up, it's actually when we see more trucks pulled off the road and more carriers going out of business. And I had a an article that I posted on the website in the forums today. I'll read that after I get through with this. I got to find it again, though. Reefer. Week over week up 13%, month over month up 51%, year over year 238%. Let's see what is going on with the rates in each segment from TransCore. Looks like we're flat on the dry van rate, about down about a 1%, nothing really to talk about. Reefer rates, flat. Right at about less than 1%, so nothing really going on there. And flatbed rates actually did climb about 1.6%. So, again, no real movement in rates yet. But I think as long as this number starts to or continues to climb, I think we will finally see some movement in rates. And you know, for spot market rates, these really aren't that bad. And even if they stay here and we just see increased load availability, I think that's going to help quite a bit. If we can just keep running paid miles at these rates, we're going to be a whole lot better off than when these were the rates and we were sitting a lot. Just having the available freight is going to make a big difference. So let me see if I can find the article. Just reminded me, okay, here we go. This is from a survey from Transport Capital Partners. They are a group that does a lot of financing and acquisitions and buyouts, and they do a survey of a lot of the big CEOs, big carriers, and stuff like that. Let me read this. Despite the fact that carriers are confident about the year ahead, 1 in 4, now this is carriers, 1 in 4 carriers are considering exiting the industry over the next 18 months. Transport Capital Partners uses this quarterly survey to collect the insights and opinions of executives nationwide in order to report on the current state of the industry and future expectations. The survey over the last 5 quarters clearly shows carriers have become more confident in rates and volumes, but in the short run, a substantial number of carriers say they are considering leaving if tonnage does not increase in 6 months. Over a quarter of carriers would be interested in selling over the next 18 months. The survey shows that small carriers are generally less optimistic and more anxious to sell than their larger competitors. The break between what they consider large and small is about $25 million in revenue. More than $25 million considered a large carrier, less than $25 million in revenue considered a small carrier. Let's see. With the total number of carriers saying that they would be interested in selling is up about 50% over just last quarter. So in 1 quarter, the number of carriers saying they would be interested in selling is up 50%. Now, even though a carrier would sell, anytime we see consolidation, which means it's not really a carrier going out of business, it's a carrier being bought by another carrier, that tightens up capacity. Because if you've got a small carrier and they're running 100 units, if they're not running efficiently, those 100 units are out on the road, they're not staying full, and they tend to drive rates down because it's excess capacity. If a larger carrier buys them out, instead of running 100 units, that larger carrier might slash sometimes as much as 75% of the capacity in that carrier. Because really what they're buying, they're not buying equipment so much. They're buying accounts, and they can handle those accounts with current capacity that they already have. So having carriers buy out other carriers will really tighten up capacity. So this was an interesting report. I've got a call online, but only one. So if you've got anything you want to talk about, go ahead and press 1. And Lisa will screen your calls. Or if you just want to talk to Lisa, go ahead and press 1 and talk to her, since nobody wants to talk to me anyway. Let's see. Let's start off with Matt tonight in Georgia. Matt, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Kevin. I guess maybe I should give a warning out. If nobody wants to talk, they're going to have to listen to me and you all night.
Well, exactly. you and I always have things to talk about. So
that's right. So I'll just start with continuing on what you're talking about there, and I mean, this article is, what, about a year old? The whole issue of post trucks, the people that haven't been making their payments and the banks don't want to repo them, so they're letting them stay in business even though they're
That's
behind,
right.
You know. They're on the verge of going out of business, and eventually the banks are going to call them notes, you know.
Well, you know, that's a good point. I had forgotten all about that, because as all of these numbers start to turn around, as capacity tightens, as the banks get a little healthier because they start getting some people to pay, as some of this equipment that's sitting around might get bought up to fill this capacity, the banks will start to clamp down on this. They're not going to allow people to go forever. So it's kind of funny that the carriers that have been getting by without even making all their payments when things were bad, now that things are good, they'll be the first ones to go out of business.
Yeah, I mean, you say it's up to one and four are willing to sell, and you know, because they say the smaller carriers are less optimistic. Boy,
yeah.
I sure got the opposite situation.
Everything I look at is optimistic. I know. You know what I think happens in a market like this, and this happens in our economy in, as a whole too. I think when you start to come out of a recession or an economic cycle that we've been in, I think the big carriers can thrive because they have the resources. I think the really small carriers, you and I, can thrive because we can adapt quickly. And if we made it through the worst of it, we're certainly going to be okay now. I think it's everybody in the middle that has the hardest time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's like you've said many a times, when fuel spikes, it's the owner-operators that have the advantage. Really small fleet, because, you know, even a guy with one truck or even a small fleet of five or six trucks, I mean, he can make some very serious changes, you know, in a week. A large carrier with 5,000 trucks, it takes a long time to implement some type of change to improve fuel economy.
I worked with a large carrier once, and I said, my God, I can't believe that you guys don't do some of this stuff that we talk about. And if we want to talk about how big the carrier was, it was Swift. So,
yep.
And one of the vice presidents of Swift, and there are only three in the whole company for operations, actually came up to Denver, wanted to go out to lunch, and really, it turned out he wanted to pick my brain about truck specs. I that's all it was about. And I said to him, I said, you know, with all these ideas, because he listens to the show, I said, and he loves the ideas. I said, you know, why don't you implement some? And he actually walked me through the process, and I kind of understood some of this for a carrier this size. He said, if we were to try to make one change, just one, and it doesn't even have to be a big one, he said it is a one-year project that we have to commit to, and you can't even imagine the amount of planning it takes to do it.
Yeah.
And he said, what if for some reason it doesn't work in our operation? I mean, it is a huge commitment to us, and we have to be very careful what we commit to. So you're right. It's you know, the small carriers can adapt very quickly. Now, the big carriers, if they were healthy, they can weather the spike in fuel prices just on pure size alone, because they have enough money to be able to do it. The really small ones can do it because if they're smart, they can adapt quickly. Again, it comes down to the ones in the middle that get squeezed the hardest.
Yeah. And just one other little side note, I guess, a personal notice, or I guess a public notice. I know a lot of different times on the radio show or on here, you quote things off of the website.
Just
let you know, whenever you're quoting anything that I've ever written, it's, by all means, you can mention my name and whatever. Anything I say is public information, the way I feel it.
Good.
I'm not afraid. I have nothing to hide.
You mean you actually use your real name and you don't mind people knowing what you say?
Yeah, I don't have my last name on there, but that, I don't know.
Everybody knows who you are.
Set it up. Yeah. But the question I did have is, I think it was just last week I told you I'm hiring a driver.
Yeah.
And do you have an opinion, or have you ever run many numbers? Now, you know, I run as a legal operation when it comes to taxes and stuff, and I'm
right.
doing payroll.
Yep.
Do you think it's easier to do on my own or use a payroll company?
I think the best method that I've found, two options. One, if you use QuickBooks on one computer, meaning, and the difference is I now use QuickBooks online so that I can access QuickBooks from anywhere, any computer, anytime, because when we travel, it's so much easier for me to be able to do that. And I have a payroll service as part of QuickBooks Online. It's not completely full service because I still have to file some of my own forms. Now, it fills out all the forms for me. I just have to file them and make sure it gets done. If you're using QuickBooks on one computer, not online, there is a full-service payroll system that is fantastic, and it's not that expensive at all. It is way, way cheaper than using something like Paychex or some of the local companies that do it. And that would be, and I used it for years. So that would be my recommendation, is to use the service within QuickBooks. And like I say, now mine's not completely full service. I still have to file some of my own forms. But payroll for I was going to say for me, but it's actually Lisa that does it every week, is a breeze. It mm-hmm. You know, she says that it takes her hours, but I know that she finishes in about 4 or 5 minutes, and then she's shopping at Coldwater Creek when she tells me she's working.
You knew that was the talk.
There she is.
It actually takes me about 10 minutes to do payroll.
Yeah, because years ago, when I had a couple of trucks, multiple employees, you know, then I used a payroll service, but that was before I was incorporated. I never messed with it at all.
Right.
You know, the payroll company was simple. I just faxed the form to them every week, and then it took added on another 24.65%, I believe. That covered all payroll taxes, workman's comp, and everything.
Now, hold on. When you say payroll company, are you really talking about an employee leasing operation?
Yeah. Yep. Basically, they had to fill out an application, everything for that payroll company.
Now, let's not call that a payroll company. Let's call that employee leasing. That's employee leasing, and I did that for a while. And the reason that I did it was because I went through a stretch where workers' comp was just killing me on stuff, and we couldn't seem to get a good rate on it, so I went through employee leasing, and I really gave that up because, for me, the additional cost just wasn't worth it.
Well, yeah, that's the only number I'm waiting on. I'm waiting on a quote back for my workman's comp because I do figure I can do it cheaper myself.
Yeah, it was kind of nice, and I only did it for about a year. Because there were some changes going on in Florida with workers' comp, and I finally got tired of it, and I said, I'm just not going to mess with it. And I used an employee leasing company, and it's a pretty hefty cost to have that.
Yeah. So, because, you know, I incorporated back in 2003, I believe. So I've been doing a payroll on myself, so as far as, I mean, granted, I'm on salary, so, you know, the numbers never change throughout the year.
I think based on your operation, you would be far better off with QuickBooks.
Okay.
And just use their payroll service, but hire your own drivers.
Yeah. All right. That's kind of the way I had it planned.
All right. I've got a lot of calls, so I'm going to put you back on hold I might come back to you, so hang around. I'll try to figure out where you are there. Let's see. Let's start up at the top. Let's go to Craig in Louisiana. Craig, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon, Kevin.
Good evening. What's on your mind?
I was listening about these rates and stuff. I know you used to be a certified financial planner or whatever, and I haven't heard you speak a lot about this economy as far as sovereign debt issue and this bond, long-term bond issue that's going on in Europe, maybe affecting us here at the end of the year on maybe double-dipping this thing and double-dipping a recession. I'm in good shape as far as I am. I know I could weather the storm with because I run very little debt margin, but I just wonder what you have seen and what I've been reading, and I just want to get your opinion on it.
Well, let me, that's a great question. And you know, the problem with making any kind of predictions is that there are so many variables. Now, typically we could look at business cycles and make some pretty reasonable predictions. The problem right now is, and I know people might get tired of hearing me say this, the problem right now is our government. Because normal business cycles don't apply when we've got a government that is attempting to take over so much of our economy. And a big, big issue is healthcare. And we're, you know, they're arguing it right now. They're going to try to push this through before the weekend's over. But, I mean, we've been arguing this for a year. And how many times have they said, we're going to do something by next week? Well, you know what? They're saying it again. And until they do something or drop it, this is going to be a very tough environment to try to predict anything. Because if healthcare goes through in any form, all bets are off on what's going to happen with the economy.
Oh, I know it is. You can't really dictate what's going to happen in Washington. You can call your congressman and senate, but they don't mean nothing. They're going to force it down our throat, it looks like. And I'm worried about all this big government destroying what I've worked for all my life, and they're really wanting to get in our pocket real deep.
They are. Here's what I believe about that, though. Let's really, one of the things I always do in business, in life, and whatever, is I always try to look at what is the absolute worst-case scenario and what could I do to protect myself from that worst case. No matter what happens to this economy, there will always be freight to move. Somebody's got to move it, and somebody's got to make money doing it. And it doesn't matter if it's, you know, a lack of freight or $10 a gallon fuel. I mean, if those are two worst-case scenarios, how do we protect ourselves against it? And worst-case scenario is there's no way going from the point we're at now that we could possibly lose another 50% of this industry. I mean, that is absolute worst case. It's not going to happen. So in order to protect yourself, you have to figure out, how do I put myself in the 50% that can't go away? Because as long as I'm here and as long as I'm moving freight, I'm going to make money doing it. So I think that we'll at least level out from here. We could see, you know, this could be what's considered a false recovery, and it could just be a bounce off the bottom. There are several things that could happen to cause us to go back down into a recession again. We're heading that direction. But I still think we've weathered probably the worst of it. And if you've made it this far, I think you're going to be okay, as long as you're not on the edge right now. I mean, if you've been through this and you're doing okay, I don't think that, you know, there's anything coming that's going to put those kind of people out of business. If you're on the edge, I would be worried, because we're certainly not out of the woods yet. But the biggest factor in predicting what's going to happen with our economy is what happens with healthcare. You mentioned calling, and I absolutely always recommend you get involved, you call your representatives. But it's interesting, you know, I read an article, and again, this was on, it's in the discussion forums on the website, about Rush Limbaugh putting up a message on his website, talking about it on the air, and generating so many calls that they almost shut down the Capitol switchboard. They flooded the lines with that many calls. That takes a lot of calls. Nobody would put out a number, but it's got to be huge. And if that isn't enough to stop Congress from doing what they're going to do, then nothing will ever be enough. There's nothing more we could do to stop them if that didn't do it. Let's go to Ben in Ontario. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Hi, Kevin.
Yeah, Ben, you're there. You're there. I can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay, good. Now you can hear me all right?
Yep.
Sorry about that. Listen, I just wanted to pick your brain. I'm thinking about buying a company out. It's a one truck company. It's a local business in my area. I'll just throw a couple of numbers by you real quick, because he's incorporated. He wanted to sell his whole incorporation and everything except keep his asset, the truck. I'm only basically interested in his phone number and the company list.
Okay.
The numbers... The 5-year average for the revenue was $157,000, and the return, like his, the actual net profit average was like $62,000 or something. So it was over 40% return.
Okay.
And I think there's a lot of room to improve that. A lot of the expenses I can cut back, and I really believe there's a chance to not only take his business, but generate a lot of new business on my own. And
okay.
possibly have to expand. The biggest thing standing in the way of this deal right now is our opinions on what this customer list is worth. Basically the goodwill of the business.
That's always the toughest part about selling any business because, you know, there are some general guidelines when it comes to pricing, but it's all over the board. And this is probably one of the most challenging circumstances for negotiations that I've ever seen. I mean, this is where good negotiation skills really comes into play because it, in almost anything else, I mean, if we're trying to buy a truck or a car or a house or whatever, there are so many things exactly like it on the market that we have a really rock-solid price to start from. But
right.
How many other businesses can you find that are exactly like this one? Probably none. So this is where pricing can really become a challenge. So where are you on price? Have both parties stated what they think it's worth?
Yeah, and they're worlds apart. Now, we've actually met two or three times, and the latest meeting sat down with a person on my behalf and two of his accountants, actually, and stated, I don't think they were exactly on the same page, the guy selling it and the one accountant and then the actual person who was doing the tax returns, when they found out basically we were only interested in the name and the phone number, or the names and the phone number, and his name, I guess, too. She told him that they had to really sit and chat and work out a new arrangement because she wasn't aware that that's all we were after.
That in and of itself doesn't change much because other than that, the only thing there really is equipment, right?
That's right. I mean, basically, it's a customer list. This isn't a business that I couldn't start on my own. And the gentleman's actually considering retirement anyways. Within a matter of time, I could have, I'm sure I could have a good half of that business anyways, but like just on my own with no purchase. But the big thing is the peace of mind that would come with it for the right price of, because I'm definitely going to have to invest in new equipment. I'm looking at close to $100,000 in equipment. And
Give me the two prices so I can kind of get an idea where we are.
I'm willing to be flexible on my end, but their end they were asking $150,000, and I came out with $18,000, and we're still talking. So I didn't get a black eye or anything out of it. We're still negotiating. So that's what I mean. We're worlds apart.
Yeah, no question. And you know, they're, believe it or not, they're not being that outrageous about their price. And I have a feeling, I understand, you know, they're going on 1 year of gross revenue, which is a fairly standard business practice to start there on a price. But there are a lot of other factors that we have to look at. And, you know, I think it's great for you to go in at 18. I mean, it is
because a lot of times when you go, from what I've read up on Kevin, if you start out with 1 year of gross salary, that formula works a lot of times for a turnkey business. You're starting up, you're taking over the assets, you're taking over maybe the stock and stuff as well. Well, of course that's additional, but basically you walk in and you start making money the way it is. Now I've got to put out, like I said, close to $100,000 for some equipment here. And if you looked at, first of all, a bank won't even touch you for the goodwill of a business. I don't have $150,000 sitting in the bank. So if you start running the numbers, now you're talking $250,000 to get up and running here, and it's still not a, a great deal of revenue. Like, I mean,
if I had to sit up, if I had to pay that for it, I should put $150,000 in the bank and make my equipment payment and my mortgage payments for quite a long time, and I'd have all those customers and more that I ever needed before I went through $150,000.
Right, and let's talk about a couple other issues. Are they willing to finance any part of this deal?
Yes, he said if I could come up with 30, he'd be willing to hold the financing on the rest of it.
Okay, because that makes a big difference. I mean, the cash price when you're buying a business and the finance price when you're buying a business, two very different things. Now, here's another question I would have. How many customers are on that list? Sheer number of customers, what is it?
Well, here's the other thing. It's a very seasonal business. He's operated it for 24 years. There's a lot of people that only use the service once a year. There's a lot of people. And to produce an actual list, we still haven't been able to get to acquire that. A lot of the people could just call up the Yellow Pages and get the guy with the cheapest price the next year, you know?
Oh,
so
yeah.
There's no firm list here. And now that would make it a lot easier for me to go up in my price if they could say, yeah, this is guaranteed, but none of it is. I mean, now there are some solid customers that he's showing year to year, and he keep coming back, and there's a lot of people that use it, you know, a few times a week too, but to have a solid list of, to be able to look at the frequency of everything, nah, it's just not there.
Well,
you're basically going on his name.
That, in my mind, drops the price tremendously, and it brings in a whole new set of circumstances. So this is all businesses are tough to value. This one becomes even more difficult to value, because if you would have told me that he has 10 rock-solid clients that account for 90% of his revenue, well, now we can go to those. If we get close to a deal, we can go to those 10 customers and make sure that if the business changes hands, you're not going to lose that revenue. And now but with a huge list, this becomes a business that has to be marketed a lot, and that changes the whole thing. And that, you know, we could literally talk about this one for hours. I mean, and I'm not even sure that I can give you any quick advice on what to do here other than to keep negotiating, because, you know, you are worlds apart, but you're still talking, which is a good thing. They're willing to carry some of the debt on this, which is another good thing. That's worth a lot. So, you know, you've got to decide what your maximum price is. And that nobody else can really do that for you. You have to run some numbers and say, okay, here's my maximum price. This is it. This is all I'm willing to pay for it. And if I get this price, these are the terms I want. I want to give him 30. I need him to finance X for so many years at this rate. And if he'll do that, then I'll buy. So you have to get very clear on what you're willing to do. And then you just have to keep negotiating until you get there or you don't. But nobody is going to be able to really put a price on this. There just are no formulas that are going to be foolproof in doing this. Let's go to Louisiana. James, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Kevin?
Doing good. What's up?
First of all, I heard it when you made the bet with that guy. He was saying that the information you go off of isn't current, and I was really curious as to who would win that one out, and I'm happy to see that what you're reading out might not be current the way the guy was explaining it, but it's correct.
Yeah, we're at the most, these numbers are maybe 2 weeks behind.
Yeah, really? He was saying that your information is 2 weeks behind. He's sitting there right there in real time, and it's not
right.
As good as your numbers said. And I remember y'all placing that bet, and I was like, this will be really interesting to see who wins this one.
Well, I won, but I don't know. I'm looking through the calls right now to see if he's here to pay up or not. I don't see him anywhere
yet.
Well,
I, I spoke to, I'm in Swift, and I spoke to a guy who does the OPS ones that did testing, and he told me how the test isn't going well, but he understands it's because they're testing with company drivers who tear up
right.
stuff because it's not there. So they're
exactly.
probably not going to go with it. And I said, well, why don't you open it up to the owner-operators? He said, from a business standpoint, it doesn't make a difference whether the owner-operators like it or not. If they can't use it with the company drivers, there's no point in it for them. And
no,
I was like, well, that makes sense.
Yep, it does. And I can understand with company drivers and company trucks, this is a tough product. And a lot of the things that we talk about on the show for owner-operators to improve their profits, this is why I think owner-operators can move freight cheaper than companies can. And when I say cheaper, I mean we can do it at a higher profit margin with the same rate because we can micromanage a truck and generate more net profit on the same rate that a company truck can because of things just like this. Because a lot of the methods we talk about won't work on a company truck with an employee driver. And that's not a criticism of drivers. It's just the reality of it. So, you know, and as far as Lance paying up, he will. He'll buy me a cup of coffee or something the next time I see him. Let's see. Let's go to... You know what? I better just go right straight down the line here so I don't get too confused. Let's go to Dave in Missouri. Dave, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kevin. Hey, you got a Mercedes in one of your trucks, don't you?
I do, yes.
Do you like it or not?
No, I don't. And I'll tell you why. And you know, it's only one engine, but it's also, I guess, the other people that I've dealt with that have them. Mine, I was disappointed with the fuel mileage from day one. Now, part of the problem was it was my first EGR engine. Now, there's also a story about how I ended up with a Mercedes. I went to order a truck in 2004, and I wasn't as informed about EGR in time as I should have been because of the whole remember, everybody had to up the date that they went to EGR. I thought I still had a couple years before I was going to have to worry about it. Then the EPA came out and forced everybody to start manufacturing EGR engines early. And it kind of caught me off by surprise. So when I did go to order a truck, I found out that Mercedes was the only manufacturer that didn't have to switch early. So I thought, I'm going to order a Mercedes so I can get away from EGR. Well, I put the truck order in August of 2004. I was supposed to have my truck by late January of 2005, and it was supposed to be a non-EGR engine. Well, everybody else in the country was also scrambling to buy Mercedes engines so they could get non-EGR. My truck didn't get delivered until August of the following year, and I ended up with an EGR engine in it. So that was part of the problem right off the bat. I never got the engine I really wanted when I ordered it. And mine's just been a lot of trouble. I mean, I didn't get the fuel mileage I expected. I had a major fuel line problems with breaking fuel lines. I've had injector problems. It hasn't been my favorite engine by far.
Yeah, well, it's a 2003 I'm looking at, but it's a perfect truck that I want because I can't find very many older trucks that people ordered the aluminum frames and all that because I want the lightest I can get. And is it totally impractical to buy a truck like that and switch it over to Detroit, or is there just, you know, it's been 20 years I turned wrenches and you could do it back then, but in today's electronics, can you do it?
Yeah, you can still do it. It's a little more difficult, and I don't think I would go through the trouble. A pre-EGR Mercedes would not be a deal breaker for me on a specialized truck that had a lot of other things that I wanted. I would be okay with the engine. It's not that big of a deal that it's a deal breaker. Now, if you were telling me you're just looking for a plain Jane Freightliner 2003, then I'd say absolutely not, because there are hundreds of them available with Detroits. But
yep.
If you're telling me, look, there are certain specs that I really need, and it limits the number of trucks, well, then that's a whole different story, and the engine would not be a deal breaker for me. I would buy it with the Mercedes and run it with the Mercedes.
Yeah, I might end up doing that. If I have trouble with it and don't like it, I can always switch it over later. I just wondered if you could anymore. I didn't know.
It can be done. I mean, it comes down to, other than, you know, the things that you remember turning wrenches, the mechanical part of doing it, it comes down to getting new wiring harnesses, which, you know, isn't impossible. It can certainly be done. And at today's truck prices, with what you're going to probably pay for this, if it doesn't work out, you haven't lost all that much. This is a great market to play around with trucks, because if things don't work out, we're just really not talking about big dollars. Let's go to Colorado. Scott, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. What can I help you with?
Well, I called you 3 or 4 weeks ago about my 60 series Detroit using a gallon of oil about every 1,500 miles. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And you told me, be ready for an in-frame, start saving up for an in-frame.
Right.
So I'm baffled by this, but I took it out, had some work done on it, and I asked the mechanic to check the charger cooler. And so I called him and I said, this was after listening to you, and I said, I want to be there when you do this. Well, then he called me back and he said, there's no sense even coming out. We got to change it. He says, I aired up, and I can't even get around the other side of the truck to look at the gauge before it's drained, you know, out of air.
Yeah.
It airs it up to 30 pounds. And
that
so it was extremely, had a really bad leak. So he changed the charge air cooler. I've got almost 6,000 miles on this oil change, and I've put 1 gallon in it.
Wow.
So what do you think? Do you think that charge air cooler could have been doing that, causing it to use more oil for some reason?
Not anything that I can think of off the top of my head. I'm trying to think. No, I don't believe I've ever seen a charge air cooler cause oil consumption, and I can't figure out how. So this is interesting. It's kind of baffling. It's good news for you. Because if this holds true, then you don't need an in-frame. I mean, I would still keep saving some money because it's going to come, but you would have much more time than what I thought the last time we talked. Maybe somebody listening right now has some idea that I'm not thinking of, and I'm making a note here. I'll kind of just think when I've got some more time, but there's nothing that's coming to mind that could have been related with the two, but I don't know what else could have been causing it that would have changed either.
Well, I don't either. That's what's baffling about the whole thing, because it is, you know, it's still using a fair amount of oil, but it has gone way down to a reasonable, you know, less frightening proportion anyway. So
a gallon at 6,000 miles doesn't really concern me at all.
Right. Yeah, that's to the point to where you think, well, the motor still has some, you know, some life in it. And,
yeah.
You know, it increased the power, fuel mileage. I really haven't been able to run it enough consistent, you know, to be able to really tell if it's increased. It seems to have increased a little bit. I'm still a little bit disappointed with the lack of increase in fuel after changing that, but.
My guess is it's going to be a half mile per gallon when you look at a 30-day period, because the short term is always tough because there's so many variables. But my guess is if you take the 30 days prior to changing it, compare it to the 30 days after changing it, I think you're going to see a full half mile per gallon. The other thing I would do is get an oil analysis done, and there might be something in the oil analysis that might kind of give us a clue as to what's going on with that. Let's go north of the border again. Greg, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How you doing?
Good.
I was listening to your little comment there about the Swift Executive, and we have the same problem in our large fleet, but it's a little bit of a different aspect. It's where the budgets are drawn. You know, we have a budget for purchasing, We have a budget for maintenance. We have a budget for fuel.
Right.
And, you know, we'll go out and buy 100 tractors at a time. Now, taking and putting a $500 add-on means we might only be able to buy 98 tractors instead of 100, and it just, we need those 100 tractors, and they're not worried about the fuel because it's coming out of a different budget.
Yeah. Yeah, that you're right. That is another issue, and I think that part of what he was talking about was it's such a big project and such a long project because before you can even get the project approved, everybody has to redo budgets and you know, you got to take from one place and give it to another, and you don't have to do that right now. The company's sailing along just fine, and like you said, there's a budget there for fuel, but there isn't a budget to go out and spend, you know, on a product that, you know, is experimental. So big fleets don't do a lot of experimenting like that.
No, they don't. But what we are testing right now is one of the new 2010 Max Forces. And we've gone, like, we're strictly an international, we're driving internationals here. Right now we've got the 370 Cummings. We're testing the new Max Force at 435. We are getting almost 10 miles to the gallon on it. That's probably a 53-foot light 53-footer, like maybe 20, gross 55, 60,000 pounds.
Is that 10 Canadian?
Yeah.
Okay, do the math for me.
I couldn't do that quick enough. That's probably down around 9. But what I wanted to talk to you about, and I want to commend you for posting your profit and loss statement up on the site. I read through that discussion forum with you and Russ the other day. And
right.
Takes a big man to post his numbers up like that. And, hell, I wish I could make $100,000 sitting at home watching the drivers work for me.
Well, I'm very fortunate. That's a 20-year contract that I've worked pretty hard on to get to that position. And it's what I've been teaching for years is that, you know, when I started that contract, RPS back then paid 72 cents a mile. And there were no fuel surcharges back then. I'll tell you how many people told me over and over, because I was young. I mean, I was in my early 20s. And how many people, owner-operators that had been in the business 20 years, told me what an idiot I was for pulling anybody's freight for 72 cents a mile. And, you know, how much money I was going to lose and what a cheap company they were. You know, it feels kind of good to look back now and say it was a pretty darn good decision to go to work for them at the time.
Well, one thing that was asked of you in that discussion was that you would post your tax return. Now, of course, you're not going to post your tax return with you. You've got a lot more than just the business. What would be nice to see, though, is if you made up a dummy tax return with, you know, the average Joe with, say, that profit and loss, and then to do up another dummy one under the fair tax so we can look at the difference between the two, and maybe a lot of the people, including myself, might get a better understanding of where, like, you know, here's what it is now with the average Joe, here's what it is under the fair tax. Post them up side by side and get a good concrete idea of how it's going to work.
You know, and that's a good idea, and I thought about it, and the only thing that will stop me from doing that is just pure time. And I may do it. Right now we've got the truck show coming up next week, and we are just slammed for time. I don't have any. We've got a bunch of projects going on, but that's a good idea, and I would like to do it that way. Here's the tough part about this, though. I mean, I can put up a tax return and say, okay, I'm the average guy. I mean, I could even do this, just throw away my three trucks because that's not the average. You know, I could take the average owner-operator and do a tax return, and he's got two kids and he's married, and say, here's what he pays now. But here's where the big question comes in is, what do I even show once we go to the fair tax? There is no income tax return anymore. Now, if the guy nets $50,000, he gets $50,000. There's no deductions. There's no tax. There's no withholding. There's no nothing. And his tax will now be completely dependent on what he spends.
I think that's where you'd have to look at another formula, which would be the average Joe's spending habits.
Right. But will this, and I know the answer to this, this tax will change people's spending habits. I mean,
yeah,
one of the big things it will change, I know it would change for most people, is I'm not going to be in a big hurry to run out and buy new stuff anymore. I'm going to buy you stuff. There's no tax on it.
Well, then here's a question for you. You know, you're always promoting buying you stuff, but I never realized this until I actually read your profit and loss. Why did you buy two new tractors instead of buying used?
Because for me, it came down to the point where the trucks that I wanted to spec were so specialized that I couldn't find anything even close on the used market.
Okay, that's fair. Well, I know you got a truck show in 2 weeks, and we got the big one up in Toronto in 4 weeks. Hope you're going to try and make an appearance there.
Yeah, it's not going to happen this year. I keep saying that every year, but we're just, our schedule's so busy already. I'm going to try to squeeze in another call or two here. Let's go Canada again. Tom, welcome to the program. This must be the Canadian night.
Yeah, it must be. I got a couple questions on my oil report here.
Okay, go ahead.
My nitrates and oxo, whatever it is there, are way out of whack. I got the...
Well, hold on one second. Your nitrates are one thing. What's the other one we're looking at?
Oxidation? Yeah.
Okay, got it. What are the numbers?
19 and 26, and I got 11,000 miles on the oil.
19 on the nitration and 26 on the oxidation?
No, 26 on the nitrate.
Okay. There's 11,000. How many miles are on this engine, or what kind of engine is it?
Let's see, 800,000 kilometers, a little over 500,000 miles.
Okay. Now, let me tell you what. One of these causes the other. The increase in nitration is what causes or speeds up the oxidation of the oil.
Yeah.
Because what happens is with nitration, it's usually excessive blow-by. And what happens then is we get all those combustion byproducts down into the oil, which is what wipes out the TBN and starts to oxidate the oil early. So is this an engine that's never been in-framed?
No.
Okay. Then, you know,
my TBN number is 6.68.
Wow. What kind of oil are you using?
Rotella, synthetic.
Well, it's holding up well.
But like my magnesium and calcium, they're way out of whack, too, on this thing.
Magnesium and calcium. Did you switch oils at any point during the sample, or did you put an additive in?
No, never done nothing to it, Kevin.
Okay.
Now, the last 4 or 5 months, my oil, my fuel mileage has been dropping, and my power. So I had the oil changed in it. I ran it for about a month. And I done a test on it because it come back bad, so that's why I changed the oil in it.
Okay.
And I took the truck into Cat, and I stuck it on the dyno. Now, she's down 3 pounds an hour on fuel, and she's down about 100 horsepower. And they told me all 6 injectors needed replaced. Would that be part of the problem?
Yes, it is. And that was the other thing I was going to say. Based on the fuel mileage now, I don't think it's all just blow-by. I think it's blow-by, but I think it's showing up so much worse because you're not getting complete combustion, which is an indication of that factor. And I wish I had more time to talk about this one, but I'm down to a minute left in the program. But I think, yes, it is time for injectors. This sample would indicate it. The shop's saying so. Fuel mileage and power are showing it. So I think you're going to find that both the nitration and the oxidation are going to minimize quite a bit, because what's happening is we're getting not only byproducts of combustion down into the oil, but byproducts of incomplete combustion, which is even worse. that would be an indication of bad injector. So here's another case where I just love being able to see oil analysis, because it points out problems long before we would notice them otherwise. I'm all out of time. Join me for the live program in 30 minutes. Tune back in tomorrow night for the podcast. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rutherford.